The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. We've got lots of interesting material for you today. We've got some, well, we'll go through some news in just a moment. Then a little bit later, I want to bring you some really fascinating history, some history I think you'll really enjoy with or just find very interesting. We'll talk about, well, why America uses the dollar, the reunification of Germany. It's got Nazis in it, if that makes it more interesting for some people, judging by the number of World War II documentaries on TV. It does. Some history that really gets to the roots of Europe and why we need to worry about, or why we need to be concerned with the European Union today. But as I said, first off, I just thought I'd go over some recent news stories. I guess the big story of the day is that U.S. President Donald Trump has reversed course on this whole separating migrant children from their parents news story, with letting children stay with their parents. Mr. Stephen Flurry has spoken a lot about that story on this show today, and he has just finished an article on that subject. So if you're really missing him, very disappointed this morning to hear from me, we should have that up hopefully later today, probably. I guess maybe tomorrow on the website, but I think we'll shoot for getting that up at 3 p.m. U.S. time today. So as I said, if you want to know more on that subject, you can go ahead and read that. I also wanted to read to you some excerpts from an article that German Foreign Policy had up again, just today. This is it's just a very quick translation. It was only available in German, but it's called Weapons for the World 2, and they dissect some of the latest arms export data from Germany, and there's some things that really tie in very strongly to what we've been talking about on this show. They begin, German arms exports reached their third highest level since the publication of the first relevant report in 1999. This emerges from the Armament Experts Report of the federal government for 2017, published yesterday. According to the Federal Security Council last year, the export of war equipment, or well, the translation's not great there, but anyway, 6.2 billion euros was approved worth of arms equipment. One-sixth of it was sold to developing countries. And they write, regionally, three geostrategically definable targets are clearly distinguished as the focus of arms exports. For example, German weapons have been delivered to several states of the Arabian Peninsula, which opposes Iran. So you see Germany opposing Iran with those arms exports, and that's their analysis, not ours. I know we talk about that on that show, but this is completely independent from us making the same point. In addition, German companies equip some states in North Africa with warships and land vehicles that could be used for refugee defense. So again, North Africa, a key location for arms exports. And then they also talk about Asia and rivals to China. They write, they also make an interesting point where they write, it's not yet foreseeable whether the fact that German armorers are increasingly producing armaments abroad will in the long term lead to a reduction in armaments exports from the Federal Republic itself. So they draw attention to this other trend, where rather than selling arms to these other countries, you see more and more German companies building arms factories abroad and then making them and then selling them to the or transferring them those arms to the host country, selling them abroad. And then those arms exports, they don't show up in the kind of the data is coming from Germany, even though they're built by German companies. So that's a growing trend. And they say, well, we could even see on paper, it looking like arms exports from Germany decreasing because of that, because they're just building more and more factories abroad. You know, it becomes kind of a big political issue in Germany exporting arms. But if they build their factories abroad, that gets rid of a lot of the political problems. And so more and more German arms companies are doing that. Then they get into some of those statistics. They talk about how Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates with 210 million with deliveries of over 210 million euros of arms equipment were in the top 10 locations. They write that between 2008 and 2016, the United Arab Emirates has received nearly 2 billion euros in armaments from Germany. So that would come to more than $2 billion. Saudi Arabia, over the same time, 3.24 billion euros. So that's probably getting close to $4 billion. They write that both countries are advancing the build-up of a militarily strong front against Iran, and until recently were able to rely largely on German support. Only recently has there been some discord. Basically, the Saudis, of course, want the Iran deal cancelled. They're disappointed that Germany is opposing that, and that has caused some friction between the two. Then they say the Federal Republic of Germany also upgrades several Mediterranean countries of North Africa, above all Algeria and Egypt. Egypt's got nearly €1 billion. Algeria, 1.35 billion euros. So probably around $1.5 billion. They write that if Berlin, with the support of North African navies, aims to secure control of the coasts in the south of the Mediterranean, geostrategists talk of the important counter coast, Algeria will receive military vehicles with a declared goal of sealing them off, basically to seal land borders. And then they talked about how Tunisia received some aid, especially in things like trucks. So you see this Germany supplying very strategic areas with their arms exports. This is something Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has drawn a lot of attention to. We talk a lot on this show about Daniel chapter 11 that discusses a European king of the north facing off against an Iranian-led king of the south about how Germany is already preparing for that confrontation. They are already building up an alliance that the Bible also prophesies. They're working with nations in this area. They're building up these militaries. They're working that chapter talks about both sides conflicting over the North African coast or along these countries like Egypt, like Libya. And we see them in conflict in some ways through their arms trades already with those powers. You can read more about that in Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry's book, The King of the South, and that goes through and really comprehensively outlines what these prophecies are, proves that this is indeed what these Bible prophecies are talking about, and that will give you a great understanding of what is happening in that region. But that was a headline there that just leaps off Bible prophecy. Now, this is something that is really strongly affecting Europe. Just yesterday, Monday, the Heritage Foundation published a new report on terrorism in Europe. They'd gone over and analyzed a whole bunch of statistics over the last few years. I think that was from 2014 until the start of this year. They found that nearly 1,000 people had been killed or injured in terrorist attacks involving refugees. So 1,000 people just in attacks involving refugees, these refugees that are causing such political impact within Europe. They said that France has some of the biggest, the most high-profile attacks, but Germany has seen the largest number of terrorist plots. There are 194 terrorist plots, their statistics show, that have been discovered since 2014. 16% of these involve refugees. So still a very large amount happening with Europe's homegrown extremists there, but refugees, I mean, 16% of attacks and plots and people, nearly 1,000 people being killed, is still a tragic impact. 41% of those plots occurred in Germany, making it the most plotted against European country that they looked at there. Robin Simcox, who's one of their terrorism and national security analysts, wrote the study, and he wrote, "It's not as if the Islamic terrorism threat appeared with the Germany refugee flow. Of course, there were plots there in the past, but the scale has transformed entirely since Merkel's decision to open the border. The amount of plots that Germany faced after the 2015 refugee flow just increased exponentially. And when you look at the perpetrators behind those plots, more often than not, they're recent arrivals to the country, and there's very often a Syrian component to it." All right, ultimately, the general public in Europe is very concerned about this issue. Proof of that is obvious in the elections that have just taken place in recent years in Austria, Germany, and Italy, where immigration has proven to be such an important topic. He said, "I don't see how mainstream politics in Europe can begin to earn the trust of voters who've lost it in recent years. They got this badly wrong. They misjudged this entirely, the scale of the problem and their ability to cope with it, as well as the impact on national security. So lots of people, it's having a big impact just on the politics of Europe. That's definitely something we're seeing this week, something that Mr. Stephen Flory has spoken about earlier this week, something that I wrote about in my Trumpet brief on Tuesday that you can look up on our website if you want to learn more about that. In that Trumpet brief and on the show, we've talked about this summit coming up at the end of the month. Politico had an article on that recently. They called it the mother of all you EU summits. And they wrote, if it's a big controversial issue in Europe, it's probably on the agenda for the June leaders' gathering. June is not supposed to be the rainy season in Brussels, they write, but they've got migration and asylum, Eurozone, Brexit, Poland and the rule of law, a trade war with Washington, the EU's long-term budget. After a year-long reprieve in which election results in the Netherlands and France and solid economic growth gave the European political mainstream a boost, EU leaders will face a gathering storm at their June Council summit next week. They quote an Austrian summit saying, it's a huge summit. Let's see how long it will take. So we talked about the implications of this summit for Ms. Merkel, how her government has the potential to fall apart. But prior to this, they're all getting together just this weekend for another summit, just some of the main nations affected. And I think what's interesting is it's 10 nations that are getting together for this kind of pre-summit summit, where they're going to try and work out some of these big issues ahead of time. And, well, that's a point we make fairly often as well on this show, that the European Union, the EU, if they really want to be effective, if they really want to get things done, they need to trim down from being this 27, 28 nation state union. It's just too big. It's just too unwieldy. And I think it's interesting then, while there's this big summit coming up, there's lots on the agenda, they need to be able to move fast. And so it's 10 nations that they look to get things. That's kind of the manageable size that they come to. And you see this again and again when they're trying to move forward on something. It does generally turn out to be around 10 nations that get together. The Bible does prophesy a 10-nation Europe. We will talk about that definitely in a lot of detail towards the end of the show. Now, these 10 nations that are getting together for this summit, they're probably not the same as this final 10, but it just shows that that tends to be the manageable number for Europe to get things done. You also see something else that Europe needs to do, more than just slim down. Geopolitical Futures had an article on Monday evening that was called Leaderless Europe. That is Europe right now, Leaderless Europe. It talked about how the leaders of France and Germany are arguing about the future of Europe. None of those leaders, they say, it talks about have any real solutions. So Europe's leaderless. But that's what they need to sort out this migrant crisis, this euro crisis, all those things that are on that summit, on the agenda for their summit coming up at the end of the month. A strong leader. But they don't have one. Spiegel had a piece from a couple of days ago where they talked about the same problem. They talked about all the problems Ms. Merkel is facing, how dangerous her position is. Yet if Merkel's days are numbered, who would be in a position to take her place? They throw out some possibilities, but nobody really that they throw out seems all that great. And they continue, it's an important question. Who's going to take over from Merkel? It's an important question. After all, the world is currently in chaos. There's never before been a U.S. president who has questioned the very principles of the global order, the UN, NATO, WTO, to such a degree. Yet at this crucial time, the German government is being held hostage by a regional party that fears losing its majority in the Bavarian state elections in October. And it's glaringly obvious that Merkel does not have the strength to quell this rebellion once and for all. So that's what so many are seeing that Europe needs, a leader with strength. Well, that's a bit of a review of some of these news sections or news stories. We'll take a quick break, and then when we get back, we will talk about the main segment I want to get to today, some of just important history you need, very interesting history, history that's not really discussed much at all, to understand modern Europe and the danger it poses.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The Holy Roman Empire has made pivotal and defining contributions to Western civilization. But its many reincarnations have also come with painful and catastrophic consequences. European leaders aim to unite the fractured continent of Europe by reviving the legacy of this extraordinary church-state combine. One of the great lessons of this empire is that it always comes back. There is always another resurrection. To understand much more on this vital subject, call now and request our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. The Holy Roman Empire is not just a relic of history. It is about to play a central role in world events. Coming to understand about the nature and character of this powerful institution tells you as much about the future as it does about the past. As part of this free offer, also request Herbert Armstrong's classic work, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? Both booklets are available at no cost or obligation to you. In addition to the free book, you may also request a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. The Trumpet examines world events under the clear light of Bible prophecy. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
There is going to be a resurrection of that old Roman Empire. Not very many people believe it, because people have gotten completely beyond really believing that the Bible means what it says. You're going to have to live and see it, and you're going to have to know that God was speaking when he said this thing is coming.
The Trumpet Daily.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in again for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Now, we've been talking about the division facing Europe, the crises facing Europe, and today for many people the European Union is a bit of a farce. Whenever it's in the news, it's usually there for something related to division or not working, that divided on all of these big subjects, on migrants, on the economy, on their budget, on what to do about Brexit. All of these things that they're failing to make any progress on. And at the same time that you have a Europe that's divided and weak, now here at the Trumpet, we're warning about a strong Europe, a united Europe, a Europe that has the potential, or a dangerous Europe. Now, it can be easy to look at Europe and say, well, what's dangerous about that? What is there to fear there? But one of the best ways to show that there is real danger there is to look at history. And that's what I want to do today, but look at some very specific history. Let's look at the history of Europe's efforts to unify, not a long, boring history of the European Union, starting with the coal and steel community and all of that. What I'm talking about is much more important than that, much older than that, and much more relevant for today. We must create a Central European Economic Association through common customs treaties to include France, Belgium, Holland, Denmark, Austria, Hungary, Poland, and perhaps Italy, Sweden, and Norway. This association will not have any common constitutional supreme authority, and its members will all be formally equal. It sounds like a pronouncement from one of Europe's founding fathers in the late 40s or early 50s. It's not. It's from 1914. It's from the German Chancellor Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, as he laid out what Germany wanted to accomplish in the First World War. One of Germany's key aims in World War I was to create a kind of European Union, a Central European Economic Association, as von Bethmann-Hollweg said in that quote. Even Kaiser Wilhelm talked about a European Economic Union. He talked about it as a means towards a United States of Europe against America. So talk about a United States of Europe did not begin with the 1950s, 1960s, with the beginning of the European Union. Kaiser Wilhelm was talking about a European United States of Europe. I think that was even before World War I. This idea was common among German nationalist academics at the time. Gustav Schmoller was a very influential one of those. He talked about, he said, he who is perceptive enough to realize that the course of world history will be determined by the competition between the Russian, English, American, and perhaps the Chinese world empires, and by their aspirations to reduce all other smaller states to dependence on them, will also see in a central European customs federation the nucleus of something which may save from destruction not only the political independence of those states, but Europe's higher ancient culture itself. So lots of people then talking about a European, basically a European Union. The famous historian Niall Ferguson, he wrote that a German victory in Europe in World War I, he quote, would have been, that Europe would have been transformed into something not wholly unlike the European Union we know today. That was a big part of Germany's goal then. Now, of course, Germany lost World War I, and the idea of this European Union, this European Customs Federation, slept. But not until the 1950s. No, it slept until the run-up to World War II. Even before the war started, prominent Nazis, they talked about, quote, a European family of nations, or a, quote, European community. They proposed an area with, quote, rapidly increasing prosperity once national economic barriers are removed. The term Großraumwirtschaft, or large economic area, became a common theme in Nazi propaganda. In 1936, Adolf Hitler himself said, "The European people represent a family in this world. It is not very intelligent to imagine that in such a cramped house like that of Europe, a community of people can maintain different legal systems and different concepts of law for long." So they were talking about economic union. And they also drew up plans for basically a type of European Union for if, or as they thought, when they won the war. In the summer of 1940, Hermann Göring began assembling plans for a, quote, large-scale economic unification of Europe. These were put together by Walter Funk, Hitler's economic minister, and he called this area a European Economic Community. That's what he titled it, the European Economic Community. If that sounds familiar, well, it's because that's exactly the same name the EU used in its earlier stages. European Economic Community, and he published a series of papers in 1941 outlining the specifics of what this European Economic Community would look like. The former EU civil servant Bernard Connolly wrote in his best-selling book, The Rotten Heart of Europe, "The blueprint bore a quite startling resemblance to the EEC of the Treaty of Rome. This was the origins of what we know as the European Union, as modified by the Single European Act and the Treaty of Maastricht, foreshadowing the agricultural, industrial, and regional policies and trans-European network advocated by the more fervent Eurocrats." So Nazi Germany had a plan for Europe that looks very similar to the European Union today. But German plans during World War II, they went a step further than World War I. They also called for a European currency system, where there would be a new currency block that would operate with fixed exchange rates until a single currency was introduced gradually. That's exactly what happened in the EU. In 1942, the Berlin Union of Businessmen and Industrialists, they convened a conference, organized a conference, and the conference was titled the European Economic Community. Again, same name. There were government ministers there, leading industrialists, and they spoke on subjects like the development towards the European Economic Community, European agriculture, European currency matters, and more. That same year, the German Foreign Ministry created a Europe Committee. By the next year, they had formal plans for a European Confederation. The German Foreign Minister, von Ribbentrop, he called for this European Economic Community to be set up as soon as the Reich had secured a significant military victory. Now, that significant military victory never came, and so it was not set up. But it would be easy to go on, and in fact, John Laughlin, he does an excellent job. Well, he has a whole book going through exactly that, exposing those Nazi plans that they had for this European Economic Community in his book, The Tainted Source, The Undemocratic Origins of the European Idea. And in case you think I'm giving you kind of, I don't know, fringe or unreliable conspiracy theory material, I'll point out that this book is firmly in the mainstream. You can read on the praise from people like Anne Applebaum or Norman Lamont, mainstream papers like The Telegraph, The Times Literary Supplement, etc. So these facts are well established. They're not well known by any means, but nobody really disputes them. So if Germany had won World War I or World War II, they would have gone on to set up something very like the European Union. So what to make of all this? Why bring this up? Okay, well, Germany planned to set up a sort of EU in World War I and World War II. Does that mean that all pro-Europeans are Nazis? Secret Nazis? Not at all. I think many of Europe's founding fathers were very sincere in what they believed, that creating a European Union was a way to prevent war. Many of the thinkers behind it especially were French, and they desperately wanted a way to stop Germany from attacking France. That had happened three times in the last 70 or 80 years, and they wanted to find a solution. Now, because of the similarity to Nazi ideas, some ex-Nazis did kind of join in some of the planning for this, and some who'd worked with the Nazis in other countries supported it. Robert Schuman, for example, he was very prominent in getting the European Union going, and he had been a minister in France's Vichy government. But, like I said, I think the vast majority, and even people like Robert Schuman that happened to have worked for both, were sincere in what they were doing. So why worry about this history? Well, Germany had these plans for a European-like union because they knew that Germany, as the largest and most prosperous nation on the continent in that union, would automatically dominate it. After World War II, when France supported it, Germany was divided and defeated, so it was much less of a threat. But the situation now is much closer to what it was in World War I and World War II, where they were planning these, planning this union as a means of German domination. Germany's not divided and defeated anymore. I left out a bit of the quote from the German war plans in World War I. I'll read the fuller quote now, talking about this European community after they go through the nations that they were thinking of putting in it. Bethmann Hollweg said, "This association will not have any common constitutional supreme authority, and its members will all be formally equal, but in practice will be under German leadership and must stabilize Germany's economic dominance over Middle Europa." And that's exactly what we see with Europe today. In theory, on paper, everyone in the EU is equal. All its members are formally equal. In practice, Germany dominates, and you can see so many people that talk about that in the news. These war planners saw that Germany in a currency union and an economic union would naturally dominate everyone else, that the largest and most powerful economy rules. How did they know that? Why did they see that? Well, because they'd just seen it done before. They saw some very important history that they saw that they could apply to Europe and ensure their dominance. We'll take another quick break and we'll get into that history when we get back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that, at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South.
What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We've been talking about some crucial history you need to understand modern Europe. And we're going to continue with that. But first, I've got a question for you. If you're in America, what's in your wallet? Hopefully the answer isn't nothing. Hopefully you have some dollars. And this is, in fact, closely connected to what we're talking about. Why is the American currency called the dollar? After all, it's split from England and we use pounds. Where did dollar come from? Well, did you know the dollars that you hopefully have in your wallet are named after a town in the Czech Republic? That's where your name comes from, the name of that currency comes from. The name of the town is Jochenstal, and Thal or Tal is the old German word for valley. It's basically the town's name means Joachim's Valley. And Jochenstal was a big silver mining location for the Austrian Habsburg Empire. They had silver mines there. They had them in surrounding valleys. And so coins that were mined and then minted in the area became known as Thalers. They came from Jochenstal. They came from the valleys. And so the Habsburg used these Thalers. That valley is where the Holy Roman Empire got a lot of its silver, and they started using the silver coins, these thalers, as their main standard across the empire. They had lots of different principalities within the Holy Roman Empire with their own currency, but they used these thalers as the main standard. Now, we'll get back to that in a moment, but at this time, there was no country called Germany. There were just lots and lots of different states. Most of these were part of the Holy Roman Empire. Jochenstal mining, by the way, just to put some dates on it, we're talking about kind of 16th century. By about the start of the 19th century, the 1800s in Germany, there were about 300 states. So 300 different principalities and countries of princedoms of various different types in Germany. During and after the Napoleonic Wars, a lot of these consolidated. So after that, there was the still large number, but much more manageable, about 39, 40 states. But there were two parts of Germany that wanted to unite the rest. Well, actually, there were a lot more parts of Germany that wanted unity, but there were two states that seemed like they had a pretty good chance of uniting Germany under them. They were Austria and Prussia. You know, Austria, everyone knows about, big, pretty country in the middle of Europe with the Alps and the home of the Sound of Music. Prussia was a German kingdom that ruled much of east of Germany, stretching into what is now Poland, all the way over into Königsberg, which is now Kaliningrad, that little Russian enclave sitting on the edge of the Baltic Sea. And Prussia was the rising power in this time, the one to watch. They were doing a pretty good job of gobbling up smaller German states by conquest or sometimes, I think, by marriage. But there were still a lot of these German states outside of their territory. A lot of this country's success went back to Frederick the Great, the king and composer. I guess it goes alongside Henry VIII and I don't know, maybe a few other Renaissance monarchs that both managed to somehow rule and compose music. But he was a great general, and he really helped lay the foundation of Prussia's power. So a lot of political division in Europe, but there was also a lot of economic division. And here's where we start to get back to our Thaler, or dollar. In the 1790s, throughout the Holy Roman Empire, there were 1,800 different customs barriers. What this meant in practice is, for example, if you wanted to ship some goods from the Prussian city of Königsberg that we mentioned, that's now Kaliningrad in the east, all the way over to Cologne, in a different part of Germany, in the West, you had to pass through 18 different customs barriers. So 18 times you had to get pulled. You would have to stop. You'd have to have tax inspectors inspect what you're carrying, and you'd have to pay them taxes. And then you'd have to keep going, and you'd have to do it again and again. It was a great inconvenience. And more than that, it was a real break on trade and on economic development, on the creation of roads and transport systems. And you compare it to, say, Germany's big competitor, France, where you've got just a single nation with no tolls and customs to move things around within that nation. Obviously, that put Germany at a pretty big, or the German states, at a pretty big disadvantage. And so a tariff union started to become a more and more popular idea. It was very appealing to the small states. You know, it helped solve this huge economic problem. But more than that, it was a very useful way to bind smaller states to the economy and hence the power of a bigger nation. Napoleon was the first to kind of put this into practice. He wanted to consolidate what he'd conquered in Germany, so he formed the Confederation of the Rhine, a series of German principalities under France. But they had this free trade area, and they would have their economy centered around France. And this seemed like a pretty good idea. So Prussia copied it. They eliminated customs unions within all the domains they controlled, and then they started inviting other nations into this. And that helped Prussia kill several birds with one stone to unify Germany under it and to help Germany be much more economically prosperous. And this is where our Thaler comes in. The customs customs union was also a currency union. They standardized their currency around the Prussian Thaler because Prussia copied its currency from the Habsburg Empire, and they had been part of that empire to a certain degree. So they used the Prussian Thaler, their own version of the Thaler. Now, the Prussians weren't the only country to use their own version of the Thaler. The Dutch did as well, and they traded around the world, including their colony of the New Netherlands with its capital city, New Amsterdam. New Amsterdam, of course, lost its name, but its currency didn't. New Amsterdam became New York, but the Thaler was still in circulation here. Spain was also part of the Habsburg Empire at one point, and so their currency, they also started calling their currency the Thaler, the dollar. And their money, again, circulated around the world, especially in the American parts of the Spanish Empire. And so when America was becoming independent from Britain, there were lots of these Thalers around, dollars. The Spanish dollar, the Dutch dollar. And so they called their currency the dollar. Hence the connection with the dollar and a town in the Czech Republic. But the Prussian Thaler, they created a currency system where everybody kind of pegged their currency to the Thaler, the Prussian Thaler. So it was they all had a standardized system. And this really helped unify Germany. You know, lower customs barriers made trade across Germany much more feasible. This allowed railways to flourish, unifying Germany in a very tangible, real, and concrete way, allowing people to travel around there. You know, without these lower customs barriers, there's much fewer goods traveling around. It's much less economical to build railways. Now, this customs union wasn't enough to finish the task. It took Otto von Bismarck and his masterfully planned wars and his realpolitik to do that. For example, he provoked France into invading, helping unify the German states in opposition to the invasion. And the nation of Germany was officially born in the Palace of Versailles after Germany had responded by successfully invading France. So this customs union helped formed a major part of this union, but it was a unity on Prussia's terms. The King of Prussia became the German Emperor. The Prussian Chancellor, Otto von Bismarck, became the German Chancellor. And sure, other states and individuals had power and had some importance, but in general, the Prussian ruling class became the German ruling class. It was a German union dominated by Prussia, the largest German state before the Union. So when German leaders were looking for ways to unify, well, and incidentally, that is why Germany's capital is in Berlin. Berlin was the Prussian capital. historically, it's not at all kind of like the biggest or most important city in Germany if you're going back hundreds and hundreds of years. I was reading one book recently that just made the point if you somehow travel back in time, just even, well, 300 years probably, definitely 500 years, and told people that Berlin would be the capital of the united Germany, that would seem ridiculous. But it did, because Prussia was, it was the capital of Prussia, and Prussia was the power that dominated this German union. And so when German leaders were looking for ways to kind of unify and cement their dominance of Europe, well, of course, they naturally reached for the solution that they had just successfully tried on Germany, the customs union, the currency union, common economic area, common currency. They, you know, they couldn't do exactly the same thing again. Well, they just thought, well, can't we just do exactly the same thing again, only bigger? A European customs union could help unite all of Europe, and the largest and most powerful European state would dominate it, just as the largest and most powerful German state had dominated the German Union. And then the just as the customs union had helped push Austria, Germany's other big rival, out of Germany, the new customs union would exclude Russia, Germany's largest and most powerful European rival, help pushing them out. Now, just as before, a customs union could not be the only part of that unification. I mean, we were talking about it happening during these plans being drawn up during World War I and during World War II. But it would be a major part of how Germany would dominate Europe. So Germany pushed for this economic union because they had a very recent example that proved that it works. That the major power ends up dominating, that the biggest power going into it ends up dominating the whole thing. Now, this wasn't the only example. They also, these planners also hearkened back to the Hanseatic League that began in the 13th century. And again, this began as a trading union centered around the German cities of Lübeck and Hamburg. But it stretched all the way to the Netherlands and to Latvia. And this wasn't really an empire, but it was a series of trading states or trading cities, really. But it grew to have a certain amount of political power and political unity, even engaging in warfare together on rare occasions. Nazi planners, when talking about their vision for Europe, they kind of saw the Hanseatic League being another example of German power being spread through economic means. And as it grew, you know, as a trading union, but it was centered around those German cities, and so it was a valuable way of expanding German influence. Some of these Nazi experts, they were kind of writing that, well, if Europe hadn't it discovered America when the Hanseatic League was kind of reaching its height at around the end of the 16th century, well, that this could have formed the foundation of a kind of ancient European Union. So once again, why this history lesson? Well, firstly, it becomes very clear that customs unions are always about empires. It was always about political integration when these were used before. And these were tools people reach for when they're trying to unify politically. And you can see why. You're convincing to someone to come under your rule and influence is hard. You know, hey guys, do you want to be ruled by me? That doesn't work so well. That's not a great proposition. People don't say, yeah, sounds good. But you say, hey, do you want to get richer? I've got this plan to help you do that. Well, that sounds much better. And in Germany's case with their customs union, well, it did that. It did make everybody richer, but it helped lead to this unification. It starts you down this slippery slope. You start trading more. Supply chains become much more integrated. So in Europe today, for example, you have basically countries downriver from Germany along the Danube are pretty firmly integrated into the German supply chain. They basically, their kind of whole economies revolve around making things that then get shipped up to Germany that then Germany uses and makes into its finished products. They're just really firmly integrated into the German economy. And intertwined economies very quickly become intertwined political entities. And again, we see this in Europe. We see this, say, in Italy, where you've got a new government that comes to power and wants to borrow tons of money. That will affect the euro. Germany also uses the euro, and so they're very concerned about what Italy is doing. And they're looking at that and thinking, well, we could lose out. We could lose money. So it leads to Germany trying to control them. And the powerful, most powerful country has a lot of weight to throw around that union, and so it uses it. This is why France was kind of pro-Europe after World War II. They saw Germany as broken and divided. And so there was a chance to kind of incorporate half of Germany into a European superstate where France was the most powerful nation. So they basically had a very similar vision to what Germany had, except in their vision, France would play Prussia. France would be play the role of this bigger state that would end up dominating the Union. Now, it didn't happen the way France wanted it to. France kind of lacks Germany's geography in the heart of Europe. It's geography that helps it have just this dynamic economy and economic vitality. But Europe also has a lot more, other obstacles. You know, Germany had that strong common culture even before unity. They spoke the same language. There was a strong German nationalist movement before the country united in the 1870s. There was even an attempt at a democratic union a couple of decades earlier. At that point, Prussia squashed it because although Prussia wanted to unite Germany, it wanted to unite Germany under the Prussian Empire. It didn't want to be replaced by some kind of pan-German parliament. But there was already this movement and this vision of Germany as a single peoples and a single nation. Europe lacked that. And so one of the big reasons why they found it much tougher to unite. Plain Truth editor-in-chief Herbert W. Armstrong talked about this. He wrote about this very clearly in the November 1965 Plain Truth magazine. And he talked about how the Plain Truth had said, he said for more than 31 years, the Plain Truth has said Europe will unite. And also for more than 31 years, we've seen that these countries cannot agree among themselves. He talked about how, to unite, they need a supreme figure, somebody they can trust. But they talked about how, they don't trust each other. They don't, the Germans would never accept a French leader. The French would never accept a German leader. They need some kind of common bond that they don't have right now. And he said, the only possible answer is help from a religious leader. Watch for developments to suddenly speed European political and military union through religious union, Mr. Armstrong wrote. This new trend may not start this year or the next, but when it does, events will flash by with a lightning speed. He said that more than 50 years ago. And we see that, they need more than just this customs union to unite just like Germany did. That's one of the key missing ingredients. It also needs a military force, some kind of external military force. Bismarck needed his wars to unite Germany, wars with Denmark, wars with Austria, wars with France. He saw those, and they were vital components in the way that he unified Germany. Europe also needs an external pressure if it's going to unify. And we see that with what's going on with Middle East, with terrorism, like we talked about just at the start of the show. We see that with Russia as well. And we've written, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has an article from, I think it was about 10 years ago or more, called on Russia triggering Europe to unite. So you see those external forces as well. But at the same time, those extra ingredients are absolutely necessary. But we can see how a currency union, how an economic union plays a major role in uniting a country or uniting a power around its heart. And this is what Herbert W. Armstrong saw all along. It's a clip we play fairly commonly from him, but here's what he said about that.
And we know which is the one and the only nation in Europe that is capable of dominating, and which is the economic and the industrial heart of all Europe, without which there could be no stability and strength. A human body cannot live without its heart. And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
Europe's heart is in Germany. Just like when Germany was unifying, Germany's heart was in Prussia. So the EU may look benign, it may look divided, but we look at some of this history and it's clear that it's part of an attempt to create a single European power, a single European superstate. When Germany united under Prussia, it changed the world. Suddenly there was a power that could outcompete Britain when it came to industrial production. There was a military power on the continent of Europe that was superior to anybody else, that no one else could compete with. And it really did destabilize the world. While a united Europe uniting in this same way would change the world, shake the world in the same way. And this is exactly what the Bible prophesies. Revelation chapter 17 talks in great detail about this power. It talks about a power that, that is resurrected seven times, that was and is not, and yet is. It's a power that rises on the world scene, it disappears, and it comes back again. It says that there are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. So these are kings that come one after the other, sequentially. And it talks about this power going into the bottomless pit. So there are times when this power disappears. The start of this chapter in Revelation 17 talks about this power being ruled by a woman. A woman in Bible symbolism is a type of a church. So this is a power that rises on the scene, disappears, comes back again, and is led by the church, or led by a church. Is there a power in the world that matches that description? Well, there's only one. It's this European power. Well, in Europe, obviously, because it's a European power. So it's this European power. So you've seen repeatedly in Europe attempts to create this power led by the led by the Catholic Church. You saw this with Charlemagne in AD 800. He set out to restore the Roman Empire. He was crowned, Roman Emperor by the Pope. He fell. The empire disappeared. You had then a new king a bit later, Otto the Great, coming up in Germany. And again, being crowned Roman Emperor, Holy Roman Emperor, by the Pope, ruling again. He fell. It disappeared. And then you had the Habsburg Empire come along, this massive empire ruling all of Austria, ruling Spain, all of Spain's possessions in America, all around the world. It fell. Then you have Napoleon coming along and proclaiming himself as a Roman Caesar, calling himself a consul, just like Julius Caesar. But again, having the Pope come and crown him, modeling that coronation after Charlemagne's, making a replica crown of Charlemagne to be put on his head. That fell. Then you had Mussolini coming along, proclaiming himself a Roman Empire. You had Adolf Hitler signing an accord with a concordat with the Catholic Church, just like Napoleon did. Coming to power, he fell. The Bible says there's one more. The Bible talks about this final power being an economic power as well. We mentioned Revelation 17, just over the page in Revelation 18. It talks about once this power finally falls, the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, that they had been made rich by her. The Old Testament, when talking about this power, talks about it as Tyre, this ancient trading center that had merchants known around the world. Isaiah 23 talks about this power being part of a mart of nations. Ezekiel 27 refers to the same power, and Tyre is called a merchant of the people for many isles. It's described as doing business all around the world. So you have this major economic power. And then finally, Revelation chapter 17 talks about how that this final resurrection of this empire is made up of 10 kings that have one mind and shall give their power and strength to the beast. So you have a power that rises in Europe, is made up of 10 kings, is an economic power. So it makes a lot of sense that you would have this power unify, using its economy to unify, exactly the way we see Europe going. There's a powerful warning in this history that we've covered today about what is happening in Europe, about how this economic unification can lead to political unification, and how that new power can then go on and shake the world. But at the same time, the Bible gives us an even more powerful, even more specific warning. There are those scriptures that are so clear that we can put side by side with history that were written 2,000 years ago and yet have already been proven correct over the last 2,000 years outlining Europe's history. And they give a very specific warning about what is rising in Europe. Yet these scriptures, you know, they warn that what's happening in Europe is dangerous. But these scriptures, like I said, that have been proven right already. They conclude by saying that this power that's rising shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. So it is a terrible power. It talks about it engaging in slave trade and all just abominable practices, but it is destroyed, and it leads to this time where all of that kind of power and this empire is just destroyed forever. Slavery ended forever. So the Bible has a major warning about what is happening in Europe. But those same scriptures give us a major hope as well, that God will intervene and will stop this power from destroying the world, from hurting anybody else ever again. So that's a brief overview of what the Bible talks about this power. We have our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, that will go through these scriptures with you, show you what the Bible says about this power, show you how that has been matched up exactly with history. We'll send you that book for free from our website, thetrumpet.com. Just click on the literature tab. You can go there, and then it brings up, I think, the showcase of literature. Just click to show all. It will show you all the books and booklets that we've got. You can add it to a basket. It's called a basket. There's no checkout in terms of having to pay for it. We'll ship you that book for free. You can read it online for free. But I'd really encourage you to get your own physical copy so that you can go through and read that. And that will give you just this powerful warning and powerful hope about what is happening in Europe from your Bible. Thanks for listening. Mr. Stephen Flurry should be back tomorrow. You can email us about this show, about any of our shows at td@kpcg.fm.